We're looking at economic opportunity across our state this week. Today, we talk about college. If you're a student who grew up in the U.S. and wants to go to college here but isn't here legally, how can you afford it? The Illinois Dream Fund was supposed to help with that.
There are very little amount of scholarships out there for undocumented students, and the scholarships that are out there are $200, $500, $1,000. You're lucky if you get one that might be $2,000.
We also speak with State Representative Will Guzzardi about his idea to make college tuition free for everyone. And thanks to a successful pilot program, Illinois courts now allow cameras and recording devices with the goal of making the judicial process more transparent.
It's important that the people of Illinois understand how the courts work. And one of the ways they do that is by seeing the courts in action.
We'll get an update on that progress from veteran broadcaster Jim Grimes. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. At the first of this month, the 7th Judicial Court, which includes Sangamon, Morgan, Scott, and three other central Illinois counties, was the most recent circuit court to be approved to allow news media to use cameras and other recording devices in courtrooms. Thanks to a successful pilot program that ended earlier this year, Illinois courts now allow those devices, the goal to make the judicial process more transparent. So far, 16 of Illinois' 24 judicial circuits have been approved by the Illinois Supreme Court to have extended media coverage. This isn't for everything. Some cases, such as ones with juveniles, divorce, adoption, and child custody, are still excluded. Longtime broadcaster Jim Grimes is a chair of the Camera and Mics in the Courts Committee for the Illinois News Broadcasters Association. He's on the line from Evanston here to explain to us why all of this is so important. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Jim, how did you first get involved with this?
Well, I've been a member of the News Broadcasters Association for a long time, since I first worked in Champaign. And the president several years ago at the time asked me to chair the committee. There was some turnover among committees for our organization. And for many, many years, the news broadcasters had been attempting to get electronic media and as well as still photography with our print partners allowed in the Illinois trial courts. We'd never been successful, and then when Chief Justice Kilbride took over as his term as the chief, we were in discussions, and the court decided unanimously to go ahead and try the pilot, as you mentioned, the experimental for the last couple of years, and now Chief Justice Garmon has made it permanent.
Why do you think courts were so skeptical originally to allow this kind of access, Jim?
Well, I think a lot of it goes back to the famous Lindbergh trial. There was a lot of it was kind of a circus atmosphere, and at that time, the American Bar Association established some rules that basically said no newsreels, no still photography in the trial courts, and many states adopted those procedures, Illinois among them, that precluded any kind of media equipment other than sketch artists that we've all grown used to. And so, but slowly and surely as technology changed, many states, in fact, about 34, I think, prior to Illinois, had allowed some form of electronic media and photography in the courtroom. So I think the technology and allowed the trials to proceed without interruption. That was one of the big determining factors. But I also think, as Justice Kilbride said at the time, there's a need for the public to see how the courts actually work. And this is a step in that direction.
Well, certainly, when I think about the Lindbergh trial, that was in 1932 and the 30s. Certainly, if we think about our broadcast technology, as you mentioned, not only has the technology evolved, not only has the media evolved, I think certainly the way people consume that and expect the information they're going to get, that's changed. So I wonder if we think about our audience and we think about what the audience expects. I mean, do you feel like most people maybe are even surprised that cameras weren't allowed in courtrooms up until?
Well, I think some.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, because on national media, you've seen trials for years. The O.J. Simpson trial, as an example, was televised, and a lot of the criticisms of that trial really have nothing to do with how the the actual trial was covered in the courtroom, but as often it was held up as an example of, oh, see what happens when you have cameras looking at the trials. But it actually worked pretty smoothly in the courthouse, and you've had cases all across the country. So, yeah, I think, and as an example, Iowa has had cameras in the courts for many years. Justice Kilbride and the folks in the Quad Cities have been covering trial courts for many years, Illinois stations as well as Iowa stations. And so there had been some experience there as well.
Mm-hmm. Jim,
I think that made it easier.
What did you take from other states' policies to form the rules for Illinois?
Well, Joe Tiber, who we lost a year or so ago, but he was the public relations communications director for the courts and the justices, did quite a bit of research. And I think they modeled some of the rules after what Iowa and other states, Wisconsin and others, have been using and seem to work pretty well. The Supreme Court laid out some basic rules, and probably the foremost one is that the trial judge is ultimately the decider who makes the determination whether there will be coverage and if there's additional limitations, what those might be. But there's been very, very few cases that I'm aware of where the courts have not approved requests for electronic media or still photography.
We've been speaking with Jim Grimes. He's chair of the Camera and Mics in the Courts Committee for the Illinois News Broadcasters Association. He teaches broadcasting now at Joliet Junior College and Kankakee Community College. Those of you tuning in to Springfield, Jim, at one point you were at WQNA, right? So I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation as well. Edith Brady Lenny is a courts reporter for the Bloomington Pantograph. She's also media coordinator for the 11th Circuit Court. Hey, Edith, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
So what does it mean that you're the media coordinator? What does that involve?
So every circuit that has approved the cameras in the courts works with a media coordinator. That's somebody in the local media who actually makes the applications and the requests to the court on behalf of the media to have cameras in the courtroom for a specific case.
I know that the 11th Judicial Circuit that includes Ford, Livingston, Logan, McLean, Woodford counties, that application was approved in July. So what's going on now? Has it all gone through? Are reporters who want to bring courts cameras into the court allowed to do so?
Yeah, we actually were one of the first circuits to apply under the pilot program. So we are just finishing up almost 3 years of doing this. In McLean County. So we've done almost, I think, 25 or 26 cases we have done cameras in the courts for.
Edith, I wonder if you can explain how you think having cameras in the court, how this access has helped reporting for you and for your colleagues.
Well, I think it helps a great deal because, you know, it's one thing to be in the courtroom and to write about what happens. But that only goes so far. I mean, the pictures, still photos that we have obtained from being in the courtroom has really opened up what the public sees in terms of the reaction from the defendants, what the witnesses look like, and the attorneys that are involved in all this. But from the broadcasters and from the television side of things, and to actually be able to play for the public, what was said in court and how it was said has just helped tremendously, I think, in the public's understanding. And that's really what the goal of all this is it's not to do, you know, a specific favor to the news media. It's to allow the public to have a greater understanding and greater exposure to how the courts operate.
Jim, how does it work? When you're in a court system now, if there's someone who doesn't want to be photographed, do they have the right to even say that, or is if they're in a court, it's a public setting? What are the rules around that?
Well, the Supreme Court has laid out some pretty specific rules. You do not take photographs or video of the jury, as an example. And if a defendant or a witness does not want to be shown or recorded, they could file an objection to the coverage, and the judge would make a decision in that case. And there's been a couple of cases where a witness was a little reticent, didn't want to be shown, without a formal procedure, like an objection, the media and the judge decided together that they would not shoot that person. But in most cases, the judges have allowed coverage of whatever is transpiring in the case to go forward and to be covered by the media.
Edith, as a courts reporter, I know you're spending a lot of time in courts talking to not just people involved in the cases. I'm thinking in particular of judges, what Jim mentioned. What kind of feedback have you gotten from judges about how this has been working? You said in McLean County, this has been going on for a couple of years. Do they feel like this is a more transparent process? Is that something that they appreciate?
We've had very good response from the judges. Any of the judges that we've been in a number of courtrooms also. We've been in civil courtrooms. We've been in child and not child and neglect, but we've been in civil courtrooms where there have been a variety of things heard, not just your high-profile murder cases. And all of the judges have been pleased with how things have gone. We've had a number of objections that have been filed along the way, and with the exception of one objection, we have been able to overcome those and been able to photograph or record everything that we wanted. The one objection that was granted was from a family member who was testifying in a murder case. They were not a key witness in the case, and their objection was that they did not want to be the focal point of media coverage on the case in their community. And the judge looked at that and decided that no, there really wasn't a compelling reason for them to be photographed, and so he granted that. But by and large, the objections that have been heard by the judges have been denied.
Jim, I know you've said that when it comes to this process, this has maybe caused some increased competition among reporters. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think actually that was one of the fears that would happen, that there would be competition. But the reality is that it has not been a problem. Even in Chicago, which is a highly competitive media market, the stations and the newspapers have worked out very close working relationships to share pool footage, for example,
mm-hmm.
Because if more than one media outlet makes a request, then a pool is organized so that you can only have up to two video cameras, as an example, and there's a limit to how many still cameras you can have. So if you have,
so then all of that footage
many,
is just shared.
Outlets, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's shared, and the experience has been very positive, and there's been virtually no issue about people having their ideas stolen or anything else. So the ethics and the enforcement is very much on the side of the media to police themselves, and it's gone very well.
We mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, Jim, that 16 of Illinois' 24 judicial circuits have cameras in the court. They've been approved to do that. What's the roadblock for all of the circuits getting cameras in courts?
Well, it's probably, is there interest from the media in those areas? Some of these are very rural communities where there's limited media, and there are some courts that still are a little bit reluctant. They have some issues, but as more and more jurists around the state share their experiences, I think most of those concerns are alleviated. I think it's just a matter of time. Now that the policy is permanent, the circuits still have to opt in voluntarily. And it's not all the counties in every circuit either. Some of the counties have not participated at this point, but more and more of them are. So I would anticipate down the road that virtually all the circuits will ultimately be participating.
And so now these are circuit courts. Jim, can you remind us what the rules are for federal courts and for other courts? Is it pretty much open access for cameras or not the case, depending on the court systems?
The federal courts have not been open. There have been some trials in some of the federal circuits. And I believe in Southern Illinois, there was a trial where audio was allowed on a trial basis. But by and large, there is not electronic media and still photography allowed in the federal courts. And of course, the only coverage of the U.S. Supreme Court is an audio recording that's released sometime after the deliberations are over.
Edith, as a courts reporter, how do you think this process helps you with your job? We talked about how this helps transparency, how you think this helps education and the public and people being more familiar with the judicial process. Does this make your job easier?
I think it does make our job easier because we don't just have to rely on the written word anymore. We can actually show a photograph or actually have a piece or all of a witness's testimony to show the public. So it helps us a great deal, I think, in actually being able to support what we're saying about what happened in the courtroom. So from that perspective, I think it lends a lot of credibility to what we're doing and helps us expand on what we're able to explain to the public about what goes on in the justice system.
That's Edith Brady Lunny. She's a courts reporter with the Bloomington Pantograph. She's also media coordinator for the 11th Circuit Court. Edith, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I want to thank Jim Grimes as well, joining us from the Illinois News Broadcasters Association. He's been one of the folks behind this effort to have courts and cameras involved in circuit court. He also teaches at Joliet Junior College and Kankakee Community College in broadcasting. Jim, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you.
Coming up on the 21st, we're going to be talking all this week about economic opportunity in America. For the rest of the program, we're going to be talking particularly about students who were here and unclear on their immigration status. How is that affecting their financing? There's the Illinois Dream Act. Are they able to apply for those funds for scholarships? We're also later in the program going to be talking about a plan to make college tuition free for all Illinois residents. So stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. By the way, you can always find us on Facebook to see what we're working on. Like us there if you search for the 21st. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. This week, we're talking about economic opportunity. We're taking part in a national NPR project called A Nation Engaged. Maybe you've heard some of those stories on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Today, we wanted to talk about college. It's clear that people with college degrees have better economic opportunities in this country, but paying for college is hard for any student. It's even harder, though, for students whose immigration status here isn't clear. These students don't have the same access to federal or state funding or financial aid that resident students have. It leaves many working multiple jobs to afford college, and studies show that most decide not to go to college because they aren't able to pay for it all. In a moment, we're going to be joined by Tanya Broder, an attorney at the National Immigration Law Center, and Tanya Cabrera, who's chair of the Illinois Dream Fund, which raises private funds for scholarships for Illinois students who are here in the United States and their status isn't necessarily clear or determined. If you have questions or comments about this issue, as always, you're welcome to join our conversation. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. We want to take a moment to start this conversation with Lisette Perez. She's a sophomore in college at Arupe College in Chicago. She's actually on her way to work right now and took a moment to join us and tell us about her experience. Lisette, thank you for joining us on the 21st. Welcome.
Hi.
So, Lisette, I know your immigration status right now is under DACA, so Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. So you have a right to work here legally, correct?
Yes.
And what does that mean for college tuition? You're a sophomore, but you weren't able to afford to go to the college you wanted to. Why was that?
Well, I wasn't able to go to a four-year university because I don't qualify for any federal aid. Everything would have come out of pocket. Many state schools cannot give me any scholarships because it's federal aid. So all my options were private schools, and private schools are very expensive.
And so you chose a cheaper school. Where did you want to go? To Loyola University?
Yes, I wanted to go to Loyola University, but you know, Loyola is like $50,000, $60,000 a year.
And how are you getting together the money to pay tuition now for Arupe College?
Well, Arupe College is like super friendly for unprivileged students. So they were able to cover most of my tuition with scholarships, and I was able to get some outside scholarships as well to pay for the rest of my tuition.
And you're working as well?
Yes.
And what kind of, what job are you, where are you working right now as you're in school?
I'm working at a Potbelly. It's downtown. It's a really cute sandwich shop.
Yeah. And how many hours a week are you working there, Lizeth?
I'm working there 20 to 30 hours. I take as many hours as I can.
And do you feel like, so it's not quite full time, but you're in school full time. What kind of burden do you think does working so much outside of school, how much do you think that affects your performance in the classroom?
Well, I try for my work not to get in the way of my school, because school is always first. But sometimes it does get in the way. I have to apologize to my professors that my work is late because I had to stay up night because I had work the whole day. So it kind of gets in the way sometimes, but I try not to.
Yeah, Lizeth, I wonder, do you feel like, does that also limit the amount of extracurricular activities you can get involved with in college? Because, or do you spend most of your time outside of class working?
Yeah, that's something I talk about with everybody. Like, I wish I could do this. I wish I could join this club. I wish I could join this other club. But I'm like, I have to work. If I don't work, I can't afford to even be here.
Lizeth, do you have other friends or people who whose immigration status, whether they're under DACA or maybe have not even been able to apply for deferred action, did you have people who chose to work instead of go to college? Do you know people like that?
Yes, my best friend, actually, she hasn't applied for DACA because I'm lucky. I have my parents' support. She doesn't have her parents' support, so she has to pay everything by herself, and like she couldn't afford to go to school full time. So she's doing part time, but she's only doing one class a semester. It's super hard for her.
Again, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show if you want to join our conversation. Let's go to a caller, Carlos, who's on the line with us. Hey, Carlos, welcome to the 21st. What did you want to share about this?
How you doing? Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, it's really difficult for us as undocumented students to be able to get by through school. In fact, in my case, for example, I went to a five-year institution, IIT, and graduated with an architecture degree. However, it took me overall, like transferring from Miami here to Chicago and finishing my past 3 years of school here, it took me a total of 7 years to get a five-year degree. And it just had to do with the fact that I was undocumented and having to pay out-of-state tuition in Florida and the different issues that we run into.
Mm-hmm. And so do you feel like the system as it works right now, do you think it doesn't sound like you think there's enough support that's available? I don't know if you graduated before the Illinois Dream Fund was able. Was that something that you were able to get a scholarship from?
No, I wasn't able to benefit from the Illinois Dream Fund simply because I wasn't Illinois.
You were a Florida resident.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I didn't graduate from high school here in Illinois. I graduated high school in Miami. And so that being said, I don't think that there is enough support yet for undocumented students. There have been significant strides throughout the years, you know, especially like with scholarships, national scholarships opening up for undocumented students. However, it's still a big hurdle for us to overcome the thousands of dollars in tuition that we have to incur every year. And in addition, also like tuition hikes, you know, across the country, different schools have. My school, for example, like had like two tuition hikes 3 years that I was there. And that was really difficult, you know, trying to manage those things.
Carlos, so in the end, did it cost you more then over those 7 years for tuition than it would have cost you if you could have gone straight through?
That's a good question. I haven't done necessarily the math for it, but I can tell you that I was very fortunate in that I was able to obtain a lot of scholarship, a lot of private aid. And also I did a little bit of fundraising on my own end. I had to fundraise over $12,000 through a GoFundMe page and in addition private donations from some of my contacts in order to, you know, amass the funds necessary for tuition. So I haven't done necessarily all the math to it, but I know that all in all I had to raise like over $30,000 on my own in order to, you know, finish school. And in addition to the scholarship, the institutional scholarship that I received out of IIT.
Hey, Hey, Carlos, can I ask you one more question? I think there are people who may be listening who may be thinking, well, listen, why should he get an advantage over students who are here who are legal residents or whose parents are U.S. citizens? How would you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I can't necessarily say that we have an advantage over students that are, you know, residents or permanent residents or U.S. citizens. I mean, in our situation, we have to pay, you know, many states, we have to pay out-of-state tuition. In the state of Georgia, for example, we're even barred from attending college altogether. So it is extremely difficult for us to get ahead. And those of us fortunate, those of us that have been fortunate enough to graduate from college, I mean, it has been through tremendous effort and really our sheer will to get through school. So there's nothing that we're handed off that we're taking advantage of or nothing. I mean, we're working. Everything that we do, we earn. And I think that's something that people need to start understanding about students in our situation.
Carlos, thanks for that. Lizeth, thank you so much for joining us, too. I appreciate it. Again, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show with comments as well. I want to bring a couple other people into this conversation. Tanya Cabrera is chair of the Illinois Dream Fund. That raises private funds for scholarships for students in Illinois who have immigration statuses like what we've been talking about with Carlos and Lizeth. I want to also bring in Tanya Broder. She's an attorney with the National Immigration Law Center. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for both of you for being with me.
Thank you.
Tanya Cabrera, how familiar are these stories that we're hearing from Carlos and Lizeth, students who maybe it sounds like at least people think in Illinois with the Dream Fund, they think, oh, okay, there are opportunities for students to get financial aid or whatever. What's the reality of what you're seeing out there?
I mean, if we could go back the timeline with regards to immigration and back in 87, there hasn't been any transformation in the system that's currently broken right now. A lot of these students are in limbo between, you know, there's a DACA delay, different scenarios, mixed status families where some of them are citizen, maybe a younger sibling. So it's very difficult for families, especially the average family for the Illinois Dream Fund applications are 4+ more in the family household. And on top of the average income of our applicants is $31,000. So on top of having 4+ members in the family, having to add the additional expense of paying for college tuition and some institutions here in Illinois were immigrant-friendly, and with the legislation that passed in 2011 that gave in-state tuition to undocumented students who did high school, or if students got their GED, they're able to qualify for in-state tuition. So it does give access, correct? But it does not provide the financial support, which is why one of the huge initiatives, Carlos went to a private school, the other young lady goes to another private school, which was a great initiative by Loyola. But public institutions do not have the leeway to provide financial assistance, merit-based, need-based aid, honors college, private scholarships to undocumented students. So they have to pay out-of-pocket for the entire tuition, institutional fees, medical insurance if they don't have it. There's all these additional fees that they have to pay for where it really becomes difficult. And majority of these students, unfortunately, go part-time to four-year institutions. And like Carlos did, he transferred from institution. And
does that end up being more expensive, Tanya?
It is more expensive. The average, you know, what we've looked at, and Roberto Gonzalez did a really good study on this with his Illinois report on DACA and the finances. This is why there's a big push for what's called the student access bill, which will allow this being into session in November, and we're going to push it through the lame duck session in December and January. But this will provide all four-year. This excludes community colleges, so the ICCB and the city colleges are not on this. But four-year public institutions, it would allow them to give merit-based scholarships, honors college, presidential scholarships. It will basically open them up as a pathway for undocumented students who are in college. But it doesn't, like, guarantee them that they'll get this money. But at least they are in competition to receive those funds, correct?
That's Tanya Cabrera, who's chair of the Illinois Dream Fund. Tanya Broder is with us as well. She's an attorney with the National Immigration Law Center. Tanya Broder, can you explain to us, please, as Tanya Cabrera was explaining about the notion that if you're in Illinois and if your immigration status is unclear, you're undocumented or whatever it is, if you don't have legal residency, you still can qualify for in-state tuition if you went to high school in Illinois or if you had a GED from Illinois. Why is it that if you're at a state university, then you're not eligible for other scholarships or other aid?
Well, the rules vary from state to state and from institution to institution across the country. We now have over 20 states that offer in-state tuition rates to students who meet certain criteria, regardless of their status. And as the speakers have clarified, the gap between the this leaves enormous financial gaps, even when you pay in-state tuition for students who can't afford. Who can't afford to go to school and aren't eligible for federal financial aid. There's a growing recognition that about this gap, and so a growing number of states now offer state financial aid, scholarships, or institutional aid to students regardless of status. We now know at least 8 states: California, Hawaii, New Mexico, Minnesota, Oklahoma, Oregon, Texas, and Washington that offer state financial aid. And then just last year, Utah enacted a law that allows institutions to offer institutional aid or scholarships using the private funds donated to universities to offer access, to offer aid to students who are ineligible, who qualify for in-state tuition in the state. Illinois could do the same thing, and it's my understanding that they're proposing to do that. The way that some people read the law, it requires a state law in order to confirm that that these funds can be used for students who aren't listed in the federal law.
Tanya Broder, what's the likelihood of high school students who are here and who don't have status? What's the likelihood of them not even making it to college or dropping out because of the cost situation?
Well, as the earlier speakers described, these are students who face enormous barriers in pursuing their education. They've worked really hard. They've gone to the same high school as everyone else. They are generally from low-income families, often mixed-status households where some are citizens, some have status. They may be waiting for a very long time for status. And in order to pursue their higher education, they're going to have to work. And if they don't have work authorization, they're going to have to work in odd jobs in order to continue. And nevertheless, some number persevere and are able to make it through, albeit on a longer pathway. Some have said, so what we end up with is only 1-2% of the entire student population seem to be the undocumented immigrants who are benefiting from the in-state tuition. I don't have concrete numbers on how many people make it to college. Some people in the past have talked about a smaller percent, maybe 30%, rather than the higher percent of U.S. citizens who make it through.
30%. Okay. When we come back, we're going to take a break. We're going to continue this conversation. We've been speaking with Tanya Broder, an attorney with the National Immigration Law Center, also with Tanya Cabrera, chair of the Illinois Dream Fund. We're going to continue the conversation with a little bit more focus on Illinois, on the Dream Fund, who's eligible for it, and also a little bit more about Illinois and whether or not that state financial aid, what's going on with the Access Act and how that will be proceeding. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. If you want to tweet to us, our handle is 21stshow, 21stshow. We're going to continue this conversation in just a minute. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about college tuition costs, especially in regards to students who aren't citizens or legal residents. We're talking to Tanya Broder. She's an attorney with the National Immigration Law Center, and Tanya Cabrera, chair of the Illinois Dream Fund. Tanya Broder, we're talking about this, and you're saying that how few students who don't have status, how much they end up, what a small percentage of those end up taking advantage of in-state tuition or being able to attend college. I wonder what you think the broader economic impact is as we're looking at what some 65,000 students, high school students across the country who have unclear immigration status. Those are students who've grown up here. What do you think the broader economic impact is for those students not attending college?
Well, what we found here, especially in states like California that have had long experience with in-state tuition policies and now financial aid, which provides more opportunities, that the investment is enormous. The returns on the investment is enormous, so that for every dollar that California invests in getting students into and through college, it gets a net return of $4.50.
Why is that?
That's because students who complete college experience much increased earnings over time, as much as $800,000 over their lifetime over someone who completes high school but does not complete college. And the returns to the state in tax revenue and other contributions are also very significant. So that's where the $4.50 per dollar comes from. And in California, we've seen that these students are not only completing their education, but they really are, they're becoming our doctors and our engineers and artists and all kinds of, and entrepreneurs, and they're contributing enormously to our economy and to our lives. So it's a very successful policy here, and I think in the many other states have recognized this as well.
Tanya Cabrera, the Illinois Dream Fund raises private funds for scholarships for students. You had more than 1,400 applicants this year. How many students were you actually able to provide scholarships to?
Sure. Well, this year we actually went up in our numbers of awarding. We haven't actually been renewed with commissioners for the Dream Fund, and we're waiting to hear from Rauner with regards to that so that we could get more commissioners on board that could do fundraising for us. But this year we awarded 52 students.
And 52 I know out of 1,000, students out of more than 1,400.
Correct. And it's something that we always get criticized about, but we award 100,000 each year. So if we, and it's at different levels. So if a student who qualifies for in-state tuition or under the Illinois Dream Act, high school, live with a parent, or, you know, special circumstance, and they live with a significant other or relative, they either completed a GED versus their high school diploma, then they're eligible to apply for the application. And we actually ask them if they're attending a community college or they're transferring to a four-year school or would they like to start off at a four-year institution. A majority of them who are incoming freshmen would ideally like to attend a four-year school, but as they start getting letters back from institutions of like, hey, you're going to have to come out of pocket $33,000 for this academic year, or you're not eligible for these scholarships. And, you know, then they start looking for other options. But the community college scholarship is $2,000. If they attend a four-year institution, it is $6,000.
Mm-hmm.
So the kids don't have to go to school in Illinois. We have students at Pomona, Dartmouth, MIT this year. We sent 7 students to MIT with financial assistance. What a lot of these kids do, and we don't pressure them, but they say, hey, I don't need all this money. You know, MIT, for instance, is giving a decent, I mean, pretty much covering them. And they said, hey, I only need 1,000 or I need 2,000. And they gave back money, and that's how we were able to award more students.
What would it take for you all to be able to offer more scholarships? You mentioned something about Governor Rauner commissioning more people. Is that for fundraising?
We need more commissioners. We haven't had, we've been operating on a you know, like a limbo operation now. We've been waiting for Governor Rauner to approve an additional group of commissioners to help us fundraise. And as a private entity, we're a donor advised fund with the Chicago Community Trust. So we just need people who could raise money, and that hasn't, you know, calling his office for the last 17 months and requesting that this be done has fallen on deaf ears. And now, you know, it's an issue because we won't be operational in 2017 if we can't get more commissioners to help raise funds for us.
And you
it
also
can't be a one-woman job.
You also mentioned efforts to create. Illinois is not one of the states that allows these students to apply for state financial aid. What are you all working on in that regards?
Well, the one that we're working on right now with the Latino Policy Forum, with the Student Access Bill, that a majority of the state institutions, four-year public institutions, have signed on, is to support an opportunity for them, for the institutions to provide access, financial access to these students by opening up the merit-based scholarships, the honor scholarship. It doesn't include MAP, so they're not getting federal funds, but it's just opening up state funds to provide for these students because they do, in fact, pay here at the institution or at the institutions that they attend, either with cash or with credit card, but they are, you know, generating revenue for the institution, and we want to make sure that we give them access as we do other students. And one thing that we need schools to stop doing for four-year institutions and community colleges is to stop classifying them as international students because it really they are not international students. They can't pay international student prices. And I think one thing that is not really spoken about is the mental health, not only from the student's point, but also from the parents and the family perspective, because of the strain of, hey, if I get the scholarship, I have to maintain this GPA, or I have to, you know, the requirements. And you heard from both Carlos and the other student from Arupe is that it does play in play. And something that Carlos didn't mention is that he is now the man of the house. It's unfortunate that both of his parents lost their fight to cancer. So now Carlos maintains both his sister, who's attending a private school here in Chicago, and another sister in New York. And that's a huge responsibility. So this is when I talk about mixed status homes. It's the financial strain, the mental health that impacts them. And Tanya, I know when you're working with cases, and I know you hear the story too often, it's too much for anyone to bear. And why legislators like lawyers like Tanya, legislators and myself, are pushing for not necessarily a path, comprehensive immigration reform, but a pathway to citizenship for the 11, 20 million individuals that we have here in the U.S. And not separating families from each other and making sure that they're not going anywhere. So we need to make a resolution that will allow them access like we do for everybody else, a pathway to citizenship, and more importantly, access to their education.
Thanks for joining us. That's Tanya Cabrera, who's chair of the Illinois Dream Fund. I want to also thank Tanya Broder, an attorney with the National Immigration Law Center, for talking to us about this issue. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you for the time.
Thank you.
You know, we've been talking about college tuition costs, especially in regards to students who aren't citizens or legal residents. But what if college tuition was free for everyone? That's the idea that former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders was championing during his bid for president. That call has been renewed by Illinois State Representative Will Guzzardi, who's just kicked off a campaign to create free public university tuition for in-state residents. He represents parts of Chicago. He joins us now from there. Representative Guzzardi, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Let's just make this clear, especially because with our previous conversation we're having, you're saying you would like to have college tuition be free if you attend a public university and if you're an Illinois resident, correct?
That's right, for in-state students here in the state of Illinois.
And what about if you're not here legally or if your immigration status is in limbo? Have you addressed that?
Well, that's a really important concern. I'm glad you guys were talking about that in the previous segment. And I think that we have to make legislative change on that issue urgently. You know, people who are here, who are undocumented, they live in this state and they need access to higher education if they want to move up the ladder of economic growth in our state. So I think we owe those folks an equal opportunity at a public education. And I look forward to working with the advocates who you had on the program and the folks who are working on this issue in Springfield to help make that change possible.
Now, you want to introduce a bill next January in the State House on this idea of free tuition. What's the idea behind how much this would cost to make offset the cost of tuition at state schools? How much revenue would lawmakers have to come up with?
Well, it's right around $2 billion every year that we take in tuition from in-state students at the four-year and two-year public institutions.
And when we think about that $2 billion figure, we think about looking at the revenue shortfall the state has been facing the past couple of years. Does $2 billion, does that number seem intimidating to you in terms of thinking about where we could get $2 billion in revenue from?
Here's the thing, Illinois is a very wealthy state. We have the fifth largest GDP of any state in the country. We have a GDP that's comparable to like Argentina and Saudi Arabia, major countries around the world. is a very wealthy place. There's a lot of very wealthy people, a lot of very profitable corporations in Illinois. But our state continues to be strapped for cash year after year because we don't do a good job of collecting taxes from the wealthiest folks and the biggest corporations in this state. Illinois has extremely low personal income tax rates for the very rich. Our tax rates in the state, they fall, our taxation falls disproportionately on lower income folks and middle income folks, and we really do very little taxation of incomes at the very top.
So that's where you'd like to see the funding for this come from.
Absolutely, yeah. And the fact of the matter is, in 2014, voters in Illinois, two-thirds of the people in the state approved a measure that would raise a surcharge on incomes over $1 million. And that money would be dedicated strictly to education. That was a measure on the ballot, and people overwhelmingly from all parts of the state thought that was a good idea. If you couple that revenue with closing a few sort of egregious corporate tax loopholes, we would have the $2 billion we needed to fund free public higher education in the state.
Right. And just a reminder to everybody, that was a referendum that wasn't necessarily a that wasn't a
people non-binding.
Right. It was a non-binding referendum. Correct. So here's my question. Do you think if public institutions became free, do you think that more people would apply to colleges in Illinois? It seems like they would.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, look, in large part, this program, this idea is in response to the crisis that our public institutions are facing right now under Governor Rauner and the current budget stalemate. You know, we saw enrollment at Eastern Illinois University, which is one of the institutions really under the most threat during this budget crisis. Enrollment was down 25% this year in the incoming freshman class. Students and families, high school guidance counselors, they're losing faith in our public institutions in Illinois. And what we need to do is not simply to get back to where we were in 2014. It's not going to be good enough. We need transformative change at these institutions to really get people's faith back restored in Illinois higher education. And
Representative Guzzardi. All right, it looks like we lost Representative Guzzardi there for a minute. We're going to try to get him back on the line. He represents Illinois' 39th District. That's in Chicago, and we've been talking to him about his idea to create free public university tuition for in-state residents. He actually launched his campaign last week on Thursday. He has a petition with MoveOn.org where he's trying to collect signatures for this, and he has, as he's been saying, wants to introduce a bill next January on this topic. Let's try to get Representative Guzzardi back, if everyone can just hang on for a second here. Hey, Representative Guzzardi, sorry about that.
Hi, no, I'm sorry. Okay. I must have been in the middle of some kind of rant.
You were in the middle of some kind of rant about public tuition and public universities. Let me ask you, Representative Guzzardi, do you think that, what kind of response have you gotten from the state and the public institutions across the state? Are you hearing university presidents calling you up and saying, hey, this is a great idea, we're totally behind this?
So I haven't gotten any calls from university presidents just yet. Right now, the way we're wanting to start this plan, we're launching this as sort of a grassroots initiative. So we're reaching out to students, families, parents, educators all around the state to build broad public support for this idea. And then when the legislative session starts in January, we're going to get our people together and introduce legislation in Springfield. And that's probably the phase in this process when we're going to have the conversations with leadership, both at the universities and in the legislature, and start doing the work of getting legislation drafted and passed.
That's Representative Will Guzzardi. He's a state representative, the 39th District in Chicago, joining us to talk about his campaign he kicked off last week, free public university tuition for in-state residents. Representative Guzzardi, thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today on the 21st Show. You can always go to www.21stshow.org for all of the information on how to reach us. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to continue our conversation about economic opportunity. We're going to be talking about manufacturing jobs in particular. Stay tuned for that. You've been listening to the 21st Show. Again, www.21stshow.org. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great day.